This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Episode 88 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Aaron Campbell. My guest today is Gathering Magic's resident art expert, and he also has abs I can shred cheese on. He is Mike Linneman. Hello.
Hello there.
Welcome to my show. I do remember the track team picture.
Yes. It was an infamous picture, as MJ and I were talking on Twitter, and somehow that came up that something about college and about a friend of ours, and there was this picture that circulated on Facebook because MJ added me, and of course, as any girl would do, goes through all the old school pictures to find, you know, the bikini shot or what have you, and two pictures came up, one with a group of friends, and of course, I rarely wore a shirt in college, and another one where none of us were wearing a shirt, and of course, MJ gravitated toward that, and now it lives on internet history forever, and I'm sure there'll be more memes in the future.
If I were in the military and I needed a picture to put on my locker or to put near my bed, it would probably be that one.
I just need some more ink on me and I'm set. A mustache that's like manicured if you want to go for like a 70s theme with like a good filter.
I love MJ so much, and as I said before, she is really, really hard to get. Like, I just cannot get her on my show.
Well, I mean, if you go to Grand Prix Portland, I'm going to go, and we will rope her down if you'd like, and absolutely get it in person if we have to.
Okay, because I can get Hall of Famers, I can get Wizards of the Coast staff, but the hardest to get person is MJ Scott.
Apparently, good-looking Asian women, just, you know, unicorns, if you will.
It's funny because it's very rare that people have said no to me, and that's not to sound cocky or anything, but I immediately take it personally. Like, when she said no, I was like, is it me? What did I do? What did I say? Like, why? And what, you know, I immediately went in, I had a big emo storm, if you will, and I just recently got politely turned down by a cardboard crack, if you're familiar.
I am familiar with those cats, sure.
Very sweet person, but I believe it's a man. He had sent me a very lovely email, and he was like, I'm a big fan of the show. Thank you so much for thinking of me. Unfortunately, I'm very busy. And immediately I was like, it's this, isn't it? And I just didn't take it very well. And I didn't say anything to them, but I did kind of stew and, you know, sort of like when your date doesn't call you back, and you're like, what's wrong with me?
Like, just blame, like, patriotism. Like, do you hate America? You obviously hate America. Then we'll start, like, a Twitter campaign of, Cardboard Crack hates America, also Canada, because Kevin and his boys are down to ride on anything. They totally are, too.
So hopefully those two will come around, because I would love to have them both on the show.
We'll rope them into it. I thought I was going to big time. I should have big timed for a while and been like, I don't know, I got a lot of stuff going on, you know, just to see what happens, see if you'd sweat for like 6 months, and then like rise up to a point and then pull out at the last minute and claim a work thing. But it's so much planning. I probably would have forgotten about it, you know.
Well, now people are going to hear this, and they're going to know that's what to do. Like, they're going to know when I ask them to come on the show, they're going to know to slow roll me, because they know it's going to screw with me.
Well, you totally got to do it. You could slow roll it and be like, listen, I'm going to need some extra EV here. What can you throw in with it? Otherwise, this just ain't going to happen. Like, I need a podcast, some Cheetos, two hot dogs, maybe a hand job, and, like, an extra free dog, you know? And by the end of it, you're going to have shark traders coming on your show, and you're just like, oh, Christ, I need to give someone a car, whatever.
I'm totally fine with the rest, though. I'm not opposed.
Nice.
I'm just saying, I'm not opposed to, if it means landing some big names, I go there for... I do it for the children, as they say. So before we get started with the interview and the conversation, though, Mike, I do want to thank you on the air for being kind enough to let me stay at your house for GP Minneapolis.
You're very welcome.
You and your wife put me up, and you treated me like a queen. You gave me my own room. I had a very comfortable bed. I had a huge mirror dresser thing, my own bathroom. I had access to all of the body wash, toothpaste that Target could provide.
That's the truth.
And you guys were very, very nice to me. So I just want to say thank you.
You're very welcome. I tend to try to have a standing offer of it because I remember when I got back into the game from an absence that everyone takes an absence from, and I didn't really see that as a huge thing of, you know, I'm coming to your city. Who's the person in this city? I did this earlier this year in Phoenix. I was there for a work trip, and I'm like, okay, Arizona, Phoenix, who's down to ride? Let's cube. And one guy's like, I'll cube. And no one else. Like, no one's put me up. No one's driving me to In-N-Out Burger. Nothing. Like, in Minneapolis, I mean, we had people run in for Culver's runs. We had people getting Juicy Lucy's left and right. And I want that to become part of our culture in the future. And I figure, well, maybe you're the first person to do that I can do personally. And hopefully we can make some shockwaves. And I'm happy you had a good time and weren't scared of three wiener dogs that we have.
Not at all. It's interesting that you mentioned the sort of hesitation to get together, it's funny because I remember when I played World of Warcraft, I actually found it to be the opposite. Like, people were so down to meet you, maybe because they don't get to see you because you spend a lot of your time behind a screen. I just assumed when I started playing Magic again that people would be more willing to get together. And I've noticed that too. Like, I see people who don't really use the hashtags. I see people who don't really, like, I've had people who I know follow me and who I know talk to me, and they always say, oh God, we'd love to meet you. And I've seen them at events, specifically GP Minneapolis, and you know, there was a little part of me that was like, are you going to say hi? Like, I see you. I know what you look like.
Yeah, I know that we're cool. Like, you know my face. It's everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting how, you know, the real world, because the game is more rooted in the real world, I just assumed it would be easier and more people would be willing to do that, and that's really not the case.
No, it really isn't the case at all, and it's really unfortunate that it hasn't quite gotten there, but I think as it gets more popular, that invariably people are going to do that because people are going to move around. For example, Jerry Thompson is from South Minneapolis. Like, his store was like 4 blocks from my house, our previous place. And when those people leave and come back, then they're going to re-engage their playgroup as, you know, the game seasons itself, where people were teenagers, played, moved to a different city for a job, and they'll come back for GPs and what have you. But the game hasn't quite been around long enough at the high level of traveling to GPs yet. I mean, really, the explosion only happened like a couple of years ago with Zendikar. So once that has finally played itself out of, oh yeah, dad came back or mom came back to play and stayed in for a little while and, oh, had kids, and, oh, that four-year-old kid number one is now starting to play the game again and we're going to bring him to a GP. That quite hasn't happened yet. It's still the, oh, I'm going to do the journeyman situation, and the settling hasn't happened. So we really only have it, like, right about now to build that culture in of this anime convention sort of, I'm going to stay at your house, and we're going to tape up our cosplay last minute. You got boob tape? Yeah, let's share it. You know, we don't really have that magic yet of, you know, sharing sleeves and all that random crap. It costs us nothing. And I'd like to think a community manager could easily do that with Wizards with, you know, a wave of the hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would love to see more of that. I feel really bad because Milwaukee doesn't have that many events, but whenever there is something in town, like if there's an SCG open, I always offer my apartment, and, you know, I try to pay it forward because Lord knows people have been nice enough to let me stay with them,
right.
And, you know, I would love to be able to do it more. Like, if there were more events here, I would love to have a rotating cast of guests staying on my couch and playing Magic. I think that'd be awesome.
I think it's something that's going to be regional, too. As we see, if you're on the East Coast, you can take a train anywhere, you can take a bus anywhere, with ease. I mean, utter ease. Now, in the Midwest, your choices are Chicago, Minneapolis, Kansas City, Nebraska, i.e. GP Hoth, which is still comical to me, and that's about it. So these sort of rotating characters are really all it's going to be. I mean, Des Moines probably isn't going to get a GP anytime soon, even though, you know, they're relevant in elections, but to Magic yet, still not that relevant.
Sure. Now, you said something really interesting about your wiener dogs. You have 3 wiener dogs and a beagle, correct?
Well, technically, the wife and I, we have 3 weens, Philip Jenkins, Toby the Toblerone, the fat one, and Milk Dud. Milk Dud's the scared one. He didn't even warm up to you at all. He's like, I don't trust that shit.
And that made me so sad because I thought he was the cutest one. And
yes,
this is one I really was hoping would come around. And I think he was friendly to me for an hour, but that was only because I had the potato chips.
Yep.
And once the potato chips were gone, all bets were off.
Dud Milk gets very scared. He was in a puppy mill in Iowa, again, increasing my hatred for Iowa. But the poor little bastard can't warm up cold quickly. But of the three weans, the beagle is actually Emily's sister, Rachel, who lives with us. She just graduated college after a little stint away from school. Done with school now, and the beagle is hers. So technically, we only have three, and it's three plus one, so it's this weird mix of the beagle thinks he's a wiener dog, and it's just strange how that dog acts.
You could call him a weagle, like a mix of a wiener and a beagle?
We could call him a weagle, or just a beag, like the weans and the beag. It sounds like a bad, like, 1990s album. Three weans and the beag.
Well, it would be really worse if you combined. There is another way that you can combine beagle and wiener, but I won't say that here because it could easily be considered a racial slur.
Yes, That wouldn't be good.
No, not good. No, but I did think of it, though. But it's very interesting. You have a love for wiener dogs. Like, I know one of my friends mentioned that she was looking into a wiener dog, and you were ecstatic. Like, what is it about wiener dogs that you love?
It's my spirit animal. I mean, Everyone has their Patronus of sorts, and I realize that, okay, so there's a story why I have these things. It's not because I like them because they're fun, they're great. They're very lovable. But I grew up in Germany. So, I want a German sort of dog, and there's only so many choices. German Shepherds have the weird breeding crap you got to deal with. But weans, they're super German, they're everywhere, and I live in a city. So having a big dog wouldn't work, so I'm like, okay, little German dog, weans, cool. So I've always thought about getting a dog. My brothers were allergic, so we never could. But in college, I ran track for the University of Minnesota, who are the Golden Gophers, doesn't matter. Our main rival were the Wisconsin Badgers. Evil Badgers would win the Big Tens every year. We would always take second. My senior year, we finally beat their ass. It was great. But the wiener dog, if you know your German, Dachshund, a Dach is the German word for a badger. So it's actually known as a badger dog. In Germany, they call them Teckels, but the more formal term is Dachshund. So this dog was bred to be long and thin to go into badger holes and be aggressive and take this badger out and beat the shit out of it. So I figured, knowing my rivalry in sports, the only dog that instinctively hates badgers is the one I want. So all these things kind of work together, and my roommate and me in college both got one. After college, we wanted another dog. We got Milk Dud, and then my roommate had twins, and he was a vet student, and his wife was in law school, and he had to give up him. So then we got three out of nowhere, and I'm living in a Pinterest world that I just enjoy.
It's interesting. I've heard things about how wiener dogs are prone to certain health problems.
They are. If you because of the long back, like anything, if they jump off too high areas, you can get a slipped disc. No different from any construction worker that has slipped disc problems. Really, I mean, you take a jump too high, things move out of place, and you're going to be in pain forever. The difference is humans get wheelchairs, and wiener dogs get wheelie carts, which, they look adorable, and they get them, and little kids that are in wheelchairs really love those weans. I like having them around, and I feel like it's something that I didn't really get as a kid, unfortunately. I didn't get to grow up with dogs, and I always kind of felt the need to, and, I like having the boys running around when we're doing a little 8-man draft in the basement, or we're playing Commander, and all of a sudden you got a wean jumping at your leg, and you're like, ha ha ha. And try to figure out that combat math now, you fucker. So I really like that. I think it humanizes, how we deal with our basement. We have friends over, have a beer, you got a wean sitting there looking at you. I enjoy that.
I don't think I could look at the wiener cart, though, because I remember I'm a big cat lover, and I remember my parents used to have a subscription to Cat Fancy.
Sure.
And in the back of Cat Fancy, they always had these pet classifieds where you could buy, really nice water bowls or really nice scratching posts. Yeah. And I remember there would always be this one advertisement for cat wheelchairs. And it would always be this really sad black and white cat with, like, the wheels attached to their backsides. And I remember being a child and just seeing that picture and it crushing me to the point where when I would get done reading Cat Fancy, I would have to, like, skip over the entire pet class of
no.
because that picture just traumatized me so much. I don't even think I could still look at it now and not get a little weepy. And just thinking about a cute little wiener dog with the little cart, I can't do it.
Yeah, it would be. It's crushing, even depressing, but, you know, once you see them in it, it's, you know, they're still their happy self, and Emily has really had a large a dog presence in her life, so when they've had, like, dogs that are sick, they take care of them. I think they had a tumor removed from a rat's back that they had one time. Just absurd, absurd lengths to take care of their animals. I think their beagle that was, like, 16 got, like, 8 different types of food and salmon and other options to eat when the dog wouldn't. I mean, they do anything they can, and it's kind of spilled over into me as well. I mean, they're our family members. They are weird little children we have that we can sometimes leave alone by themselves.
Sure, I can certainly understand that. I feel that with my cat, too. So I want to talk about you and Gathering Magic. Now, people at Gathering Magic seem to have their various niches, and your niche seems to be art. So what is it about the art that sort of excites you or made you decide to make that your focus?
Well, I think that's what started everybody, really. I mean, no one goes into this game thinking, I love doing math! You know, you don't really think that right away. And I guess that started me to notice this among all the noise, you know, in the 90s that had, you know, AD&D 2nd Edition was out, so there was some great art with that. We played that in our Boy Scout troop. And Magic clearly followed because it was, you know, right around the same time, and, you know, nerd things breed other nerd things. And those geeky hobbits really, like, kind of, I looked in Lord of the Rings and I thought, well, what can I do on a daily basis with this? And lo and behold, there was, you know, Magic advertisements, and it was cool, it was interesting that there was this surface level of dragons are big, yay, elves, and then it's like, whoa, actually, that's just one part, one facet to the very deep, well thought of timeline, because I came in right around 4th edition. Legends was just finishing, which made no sense story-wise. It was just D&D characters that the players had, and they're like, let's make them into cards that are crowers, just terrible ideas. But
it was really hard to pronounce names.
Oh, incredibly difficult. They were D&D characters. I mean, these were the spirit avatars of the players in the 90s, and you can clearly tell. They're like, oh, okay. Even some of the card art is like, oh, come on, man. It looks like someone just made it in 15 minutes. But some of the other ones that I started seeing of, oh, who's this Weatherlight situation? I'm like, oh, there's a dragon, a thief, but it really dove into showing a graphic novel of a very long period of time without having to be solitary. Really discussing and reading by myself, which I could never really get into as much as I really wanted to, whereas this became, I can play the game and I can discuss what the hell's going on with the person next to me, and we both found this lore, this storyline to be interesting, and art was the most visible thing that I was drawn to.
Mm-hmm. And I've heard that before when I've had people on the show and I've asked them, you know, how did you get started playing Magic? It starts with them being in the cafeteria, yep. Or it starts with them being at a family gathering and being a small child and seeing people older than you play. And the first thing you do is, what is that? And there's a card that just sort of draws you in.
Yeah.
And I can remember I started playing in 7th grade. I was in junior high. I'll never forget it. And I was in Miss Hilmer's class with my friend Sam, and she had a binder of cards. And I remember Siobhan Dragon. This was 4th edition.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Ice Age had come out around that time, too, and she had a Jester's Cap
yes.
in a plastic case, and she was very proud of that card. And I remember then she had the Jester's Mask to go with it. And then I remember there was a card from Ice Age called Hyalopterus Lemur.
Yep.
And it was this really cute little koala thing, but the flavor text made it seem like it could destroy a whole army. And I remember those pieces being the first pieces of art that I saw, and being a 7th grade kid, you know, the fearsome dragon, the cute little koala, the creepy jester man. What is this game? And that's what sucked me into it.
Yeah, and it does for a lot of people, because it's just so different than anything. And once I started just examining it closer and closer, and I'm just like, what's up with the art? Why is it so different than anything else? Again, grew up in Germany, so we had Grimm's Fairy Tales. I mean, that's where I grew up, Black Forest type jam. I mean, that was what you saw, and this was before any movies got made. We had, like, terrible cartoons that were cheating shit, but this felt similar of this, you know, Renaissance-type looking, really cool-looking art, especially right around that time of, like, Urza Saga or so, when I really dove into some of that, and I said, oh, wow, this is really well done. I want to know what's going on. And I still remember that my first card was Killer Bees. I don't know why I remember that from the card.
I have a story about Killer Bees.
Go ahead.
Killer Bees is burned in my mind for a terrible reason. My mother and I were evicted from our first apartment. When I was in 8th grade, I want to say. So I had just started playing Magic, because I started playing Magic in 7th grade. I was evicted in 8th grade, 8th or 9th grade. And it was very traumatic for me, and I'll never forget it. And I just told this story the other day, so it's very funny that it's coming up again. I remember being on the couch, and they had moved our couch onto the front lawn while the movers were taking our things. And I was watching it all happen, because I was very traumatized, obviously. And I remember the movers taking the cushions from our couch. So I'm sitting on a couch with no cushions. There's no cushions on the bottom. There's no cushions on the side. I'm just sitting on a bare couch watching this eviction happen. And after he pulls the cushions, there's a killer bee. The card, Killer Bees, is in between my couch cushions. And I remember the art. I think it was Phil Foglio. And I will never forget that card. I remember looking at that card and going, oh, where am I going to put my killer bees? And it's so funny that you mention that, because that card, whenever I think of that card, I go back to being a kid, and I remember the day we were evicted. And it's a little traumatic for me.
That was incredibly traumatic. Holy crap.
Yeah, but Magic was there even for that. Well, and that was my – and even when all the eviction stuff was happening, I remember looking at that card and going, where am I going to put my Magic cards? You know, my first thought wasn't where are we going to live? What are we going to do? It was, where am I going to put my cards?
Yeah, you know, it's priorities at the time. You really focus on those sort of things.
Right.
So it's strange.
Right.
Well, I'm happy I didn't actually buy – I had an opportunity to actually buy that art, the original one of it, and me being an original art fan – I didn't, for whatever reason. It was, you know, astronomically expensive. And any of the old arts, they're very, very small. I mean, you had to fit onto a scanner, so they're, you know, the size of a piece of paper. They're tiny. So I'm actually happy I didn't have that on the wall. If God, you would have had flashbacks in my house. It would have got a little weird there.
I also think the art does a really good job of tying into the flavor text. Because if you see a card with really cool art, again with the Hylopteris lemur, and then the flavor text is really good, you want to know more about that. Like I remember, you mentioned Weatherlight and Tempest. I was a really big fan of those too, and I remember seeing Miri and going, who's Miri? What does she do? She looks awesome. And, you know, through the flavor text that went along with her art, you were able to get a glimpse into her personality. And then that made you want to read the books when they were a thing. And they did a really good job of leading you on to different things.
Right, and they had a lot of holes in that on purpose of, who is this person? Why are all these Weatherlight people on card art? And they stopped doing that for a while because it wasn't that popular with people. And they finally brought that back with Planeswalkers, where you got to see, okay, well, what does Jace actually cast? What does he actually do? He's like, oh, he's a mind mage, and he wears a sweatshirt, and he's just like you! It's like, yeah, okay, but what does he actually do? Does he cast just counter spells all day? Like, well, no, he casts drakes and all sorts of blue crap. But showing that was really, really helpful to really get an insight into, okay, well, what are they actually doing? What, because you can't correlate the spells in the books or even the ebooks anymore to really see, you know, oh, they're casting Soul Ring. Oh, I totally get it. Or they're doing Rancor. The first couple books did that, and it was fine for the time, but, you know, you reread them and you're like, oh man, this is straight up a Magic battle, like 101, like 1995. I know exactly the timeline. But I definitely get that point of really being a deep glimpse into what's going on. And those ones are great, which give you the flavor insight. And then there are the flavor text that I personally enjoy that really give the, something oozes out of it. For example, Rancor, which is one of the best flavor texts ever written, and it's hatred outlives the hateful. And it's exactly what the card does. You're supposed to think of this as, yeah, it's this elf and he's powering up a dude. It's like, no, 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 no. This is some sort of vengeful, evil thing that elves aren't supposed to normally do. This should be a rare thing for a terrible happening. And once it happens, they basically, you know, this person is a sacrificial lamb of sorts. And you really look into it and be like, wow, that's pretty dark, actually. And all of those things throughout time, they swing and a miss, and sometimes they hit, and sometimes they don't.
Yeah. So we've talked a bit about the art of the past. Let's talk about where the art is right now. So if you had to, on a scale of 1 to 10, How would you rate the current cycle of art, like Theros, Return to Ravnica? Are we in a good place art-wise?
Well, I hate rating this. It's such a struggle to do this. I would say we're probably at about a 7 to... I'd say about a 7, probably.
7? Okay.
7. Now, the ideal is to get it to a theoretical 10 would be you're making fine art. You're making fine art, museum quality, some sort of, you remove the card from it and you have an amazing artwork that speaks to something not only in society, but also shows a deep glimpse into the game that gives you this, oh, I see what happens here. Oh my God, that's life-changing, life-altering, which I know some people have had that, where they've seen a card and said, oh my God, this responds to my childhood. And they have
specific artists, even. I know Therese Nielsen tends to evoke that response a lot.
She does.
I remember when I had some friends of mine, they got the original art of Enter the Infinite, I believe it was.
Yes.
And that was beautiful. And I remember Descendant's Path was another one where people were, there were so many little things jammed into that art where people were like, this reminds me of this, and that little detail makes me think of this. And she's one of the artists I tend to hear that a lot from.
Yeah, she has that sort of evocative nature to her, and frankly, people look for it in hers, even if it isn't always there, which is fine, but she definitely fills that niche because she doesn't look like anything else in the set. And on the flip side, to see that, there's actually other very triggering things that have been happening as of late. For example, the card Nierheath Stalker, if you look at the promo version, it's a WPN promo, and it's a vampire, it's a red vampire, and he's standing by the door with a quiet motion over his mouth, and you see all sorts of dead people inside. And while that doesn't seem to be that important, I mean, there could be anything from, this reminds me of a rape thing that happened. And those sort of things, Magic is starting to claw away at, where, you know, they couldn't show blood, they couldn't show gore, they couldn't do any of these things, and they found them slip through. Well, they're kind of pushing the boundary a little more, and me seeing art like that says, ooh, okay, I see what you did there. And you start to see this flavor that exudes some of these more adult themes and these more adult, really, emotions in just showing some of the artworks. Chris Ron has done some of this, too, that, you know, if you're a sailor and you see some of the things saying, wow, you did research to find out this specific thing, and I relate to that perfectly. Now, most of us miss these things every single time, but as they get more flavorfully deep into settings, this top-down design, these things are coming through more and more. So right now, it's like a 7, but most of the TCGs are much lower. I mean, my God, some of those artists are, like, I hate to say this, but Ascension has atrocious art. It has terrible, and not because the artist is bad. It's because the artist was asked to do everything, which you just can't do. So it could be better eventually, but they seem to be in a transitionary time right now. They have a lot of their hard hitters, but some of the people that used to pop in more often aren't as available anymore. Donato Giancolo doesn't show up much. Todd Lockwood makes a dragon rarely at best. These people have kind of gotten beyond those sort of works. Rebecca Gay doesn't make anything for Magic anymore, and you know she's getting contacted. But you got to put this new talent in, and when will it kind of stabilize again into a rotating cast of characters that are, you know, Mike Lim, who's Darken, or Taylor Jacobson, that are start being, okay, these guys are in all the sets, we're going to see them all the time. Cynthia Shepherd is going to start getting some bad-ass, evocative, emotional pieces, because she can do it, and she can do it beautifully well. And once those finally shake out, and I don't know if they're quite there yet, because they added some new art directors, but once they do, I think the art will elevate one more time in the very, very near future.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to what you said about them pushing the envelope a little bit, because I know one attempt of them trying to do that was the Triumph of Ferocity card. And that was a card that created a huge uproar, and it ultimately led to, I think, even Mark Rosewater, or was it Elaine Chase?
It was Elaine
Chase. Issuing an apology and saying, we didn't mean for this to happen, we had no idea. You know, is it worth it for them to try to push the envelope? Like, do you think that was just a misfire?
I think that was a misfire. I really do. Because James Ryman is actually very very adept at those sort of things. If you've seen the card Curse of Swine, which is the comical woman next to pigs, but really look at what's going on. Of this isn't a wispy thin woman. This is she could be in our real world, and you'd be like, oh yeah, that's a black woman. You got a lot of robot, not a big deal. So that piece is a couple of things happened. One, it's an art description that got written that maybe the sketch was chosen wrong. Maybe the arrangement was wrong. Maybe they couldn't change it at final and decided to go with it. Because in a vacuum, it's, all right, this person is trying to kill this person, which is fine. That's not a big deal. But there's a couple problems with it. And the big problem that I see as, working with art so closely and as a former art director is that I see that it appears to me that something was shifted in the balance between the two characters. And in order to fix that, I would guess that Garrick had to be pushed closer. And by Duke, because he's 8 feet tall, the dude's enormous. And if you see how it tapers down from his shoulder to his hand, it gets small quick, real quick. That I would argue that he was probably outside the frame, and they had to push him in to make it fit. And if his leg is right there, you've got to put that leg somewhere. You can't put it over the top of the layer. So they're like, all right, well, let's find a solution. Well, we can put it in between her legs. Well, seems fine in a vacuum. You're like, oh, I got to make it fit, art-wise. But once you see a finalized product, it's like, oh, yeah, this looks fine. Until someone takes it out of context, outside the frame, and you're like, oh, my God, this is, whoa, how did you miss this?
Mm-hmm. And see, I'm one of the few people that actually didn't have a problem with that card, and I had written about the card on my WoW blog. Like, when I was still playing WoW, it was at the tail end of my WoW career, just starting to get back into Magic, I had heard about the kerfuffle, and I'm very much context girl. Like, I really use context as a way to understand things, and I felt like I knew what was going on there. I knew that Liliana had fucked Garrick over pretty hard. I knew that he had a lot of reasons to be upset with her. I also knew that she was a very powerful person. And that it wasn't as if Hannah from the Weatherlight was being chased by Garrick, where doesn't have a chance, I knew that Liliana could keep up with Garrick, and I wasn't worried about her in that regard. And I also saw from the picture, you could see that she's clearly revving up to do something. It's not as if it's like a Harlequin romance where her dress is ripped and she has nothing and she's just looking out at you like, save me. No, she's ready to do something.
We can make those points, but those could have been added late. I mean, if that fire isn't in her hand, it's, oh my God, someone needs to get fired internally. Legitimately, an art director needs to get fired. Period. Like, that's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Even to showing the tiny little bit of sliver of skin with the moved skirt to the opened mouth that she has. I mean, those things are, you have to be careful of this. This isn't a tiny game in Lithuania that 15 people play. This is a global brand that Hasbro has to account to shareholders for. I mean, you can't wing this. You really have to have more checks and balances in place to really go through each individual artwork. And we did that as art directors at Fantasy Flight, where you have the whole list out there. It looks like uncut sheets. And you have to go through every single one to look at it and say, is there something that I missed that, in high res or only in a JPEG or a TIFF image I didn't see? Because in here, it looks or reads differently. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, whether someone had an off day, this one slips through, and every future artwork will be referenced to this. And for the longest time, they really got away from that. Sarah Angel was a little too hoochie, or, this is... Earthbind had basically a naked fairy, and it's kind of cutesy because it was like, the game is new, we didn't know. Now, there's really no reason this should have gotten through. Whoever fell asleep at the wheel, I don't know, but I'd like to think it was last minute change, they were in a rush, they got hurried by another department, because, my God, heads can roll at any company over this. Easily. I mean, even Ryman's probably still facing backlash from it. It gets referenced every couple months.
Well, I seem to recall when the kerfuffle first happened that Mark Rosewater wasn't going to apologize for it. And I remember specifically what he said. He was like, I have to stand up for context. That was the exact line that he said. And I remember he wrote a Tumblr post about this. And I was actually really happy that he had stood his ground, because on the WoW side of things, we were dealing with a controversy along those same lines where some dialogue had been added to the new expansion that people thought was sexist. And I did not understand where that outcry was coming from either. And I really felt like Blizzard had caved very quickly to the pressure. So, you know, I was still really kind of upset about that. So I was really proud of Mark going, I understand where you're coming from. I'm not denying you your opinion, but this is how we've taken it. This is what we think it is, and I have to stand up for that. Unfortunately, a week later, he backpedaled and apologized, or Elaine apologized.
You probably got told to. But then, even if there's context, is fine. Is it that good of an image? I mean, is it really? This is the sketch that was chosen? Two people standing that we could see both their faces, and they're just kind of stiff? I mean, that's the best? I mean, really? There wasn't a better sketch than this? You know, so it's hard for me to be like, oh, darn it, that happens sometimes. It's like, well, no, this is a shitty, this is a bad image, bad composition. It could have been better, and we should hold them to higher standards.
There was also a lot of outcry recently regarding the change to slivers. I know a lot of the art fans were not happy with the decision to make them more bipedal. Was that something you were also outraged about?
Well, I wasn't so much outraged about it. I mean, I understand that, you know, you can only beat a horse for so long, and it's true, but I am near 99% certain that that change came from somewhere else. Because in every single creative member who, you know, I follow them all, very few of them are on social media, the creative team would be like the writers and Jenna Helen and Doug Beyer and the art directors, it was all the same message. It was this, you know, we had to change this stuff. There wasn't enough interesting things going on, and, you know, we ran out of options. It's like, really? Really? This is what you went with? Some generic thing that anyone on DeviantArt has made in art school? Really? Like, come on. You can't pull that bullcrap by us. And they should have known. Like, you can't mess with some of the core things that are uniquely magic. You can't make the, you know, mirrored in randomly being like, we got moss everywhere now! You know, it's cool, it's different! It's like, no, don't do that! And the Phyrexian invasion was, you know, subtly planned, but they could always take it away if they needed to, if, you know, it didn't test well or what have you. But this seems like no one looked this over. No one tested it. No one checked it. And because of it, we're probably not going to get them anytime soon because people are super fired up about it. And you can't reprint something that people are just going to get pissed about again. That's just stupid. And since it's on this yearly timeline, you know, you can just switch something out right away. Maybe put allies in, as most people said, would have been wonderful. Or, you know, put a little commission in. There weren't that many of them. You can make something slightly variant to that without much trouble. So it just made me sad that I wish they could have pushed it somehow. And you know there were 15 people that were like, oh, I fixed it. Oh, I made it better. I made an alteration over the top. And I'm like, oh, that's cool, great, good for you. But is that really, really needed to say, we want a little bit of the same from the past, this nostalgia, and have it be literally the same thing you need? So I can see from a brand perspective how they wanted to switch it up a little bit, but they took away the uniqueness. And by doing that, they literally killed the characters, and I don't even play them in my Sliver deck. I have a Sliver Commander deck, and I don't even play them. I should, but I'm like, they're not that amazing. They're kind of ugly. So not a fan.
You mentioned the disconnect between different departments and how it can lead to deaths. I want to talk about how the art influences the storyline. And there was a lot of outcry on Twitter this past weekend when people were watching the Pro Tour coverage, because a lot of people had finally gotten around to reading the latest ebook from the Theros storyline. And we are going to cover spoilers, so if you haven't quite read the books yet, you may want to pause this or skip over it.
But
most of the outcry had to do with the fact that Elsbeth appears to have died. And there are some people who feel like maybe it's not a permanent death. Maybe the door is open for her to come back. But people were very upset about this. And they were upset about that it happened. They were upset about how it went down. And then it led to people going backwards. And people were not happy with the way Return to Ravnica storyline turned out. Are these criticisms valid to you? Like, have you been happy with the way the storylines have gone?
Well, there isn't really a storyline anymore, to be honest with you. I mean, the storyline died when the novel stopped being printed. There's a reason why Liliana has to get covered in so many other areas, because her book never got made. They had a book planned that Liliana would get her own book, and we'd learn all about her and all her weird things, which, to be honest, is the thing we need to be understanding most, because Black has no depth. It's, you're really selfish, and you're evil. It's like, oh my Christ, no, that's not how Black works. And that would have really, really enriched that color pie, so Mark Rosewater wouldn't have to yell at people every time they don't understand what Black's motivation is. But without the books that people didn't read, they just had a fat pack and threw the book away, you don't really get that. You had to do the Scars of Mirrodin immersive thing online that they had, or the Innistrad viral story, whatever. And you don't really always understand what's going on. The Mirrodin Purin in New Phyrexia. I mean, I worked on New Phyrexia, so I'm like, oh, I know who wins, whatever. But other people got really pissed off when they're like, oh, Mirrodin Purin didn't win. Oh, they lost? That's it? It's over? I thought Malira was supposed to be this, you know, Silvok protector, and she'd get through. Like, no, nope, just kidding. Everyone dead. And same thing happened with Deicide getting spoiled. I mean, you saw the artwork, you're like, oh, Elspeth kills Xenagos. Oh, okay. That escalated quickly. And it really builds up this, we're going to have a huge build-up, second set conflict, third set, some sort of resolution or something to bookend the set, and there wasn't anything. It was, boom, over. Elspeth kills the bad guy, Elspeth dies, and blah, we're done. We're going to go somewhere new in the fall. Don't you love cons? There's no dragons. It's like, that cheapened it. I feel angry as someone who actually reads this crap that I was conned into investing into even caring, because it was handled and finished so quickly. Hellvault opens, and Hellvault closes. Okay, well, what happened with Liliana? What's Garrick up to? What the hell's going on here? And they're like, oh, we'll see you soon. There's the next thing. We'll explain it. And there's just nothing. So we have these great gaps of time that people lose that interest and they just disappear. Utterly disappear. Other than Jace in, you know, spoiler alert, in Return to Ravnica being the living guild pack, that he's this magical enchantment guy, but he's not an enchantment, but he keeps everybody together, and he's the judge and all these things. It's like, well, that's kind of dumb. we could have handled that better, had a cooler explanation. And instead, it was Return to Ravnica really got examined closer because of how rapidly this story ended. I loved Elspeth. I mean, we have someone that cosplays as her every 15 minutes, and you're just going to kill her? Why would you do that? Did you not do any market research? If you're going to look into this, who's the next person? No one identifies with Chandra. People dress up like her, or Nyssa, or Kiara, but there's no depth. There's nothing else there. And I know Elspeth wanted some redeeming moments, but is really the Madam Butterfly or Miss Saigon ending really the best? I sacrificed myself for something else? It feels cheap. I get it that it's a trope, but you know, did we really need that? Do we need a resurrection spell to bring this back? I don't know.
Well, to go even further than that, I still wasn't entirely clear on why Xenagos ascending was bad. You know, like, so from what I understand, so he's a planeswalker, and he decides he wants to ascend to godhood, and he decides he wants to be the god of revels. And from what I understand, a revel is just a more hardcore version of a party, if you will. So, number one, where did the original red-green god go? Like, was there just a vacancy there, or did he get rid of him or her? And why is him filling that spot so bad? Because it's obvious there was, I mean, if there's an Azorius god in Afara and there's a Golgari god in Farika, there had to have been a Gruul one at some point.
That's a fair
point. So if he takes that spot, why is that such a bad thing? Like, I could say, like, yeah, exactly. I just didn't understand where the threat was. Okay, so he's the new Gruul god, he wants to throw a bunch of rebels, why is this a bad thing? Like, I could see if it was, you know, I'm going to ascend the pantheon and be the only god. Like, I could see if he ascends and he wants to kill the other gods. Okay, I could see that. I could see that being bad news. But I just didn't get the feeling of, like, why is this urgent? Where's the problem here?
People identified that to say, where was the old one? You know, could we get at least some insight there? And I get it that the red-green is this chaotic, it upsets the balance, these rebels can't work in modern civilization, society can't handle Andrew W.K. party all the time, because everyone's going to be decimated, which, you know, coincidentally is red-green, nailed it. I get that point. I understand that point of, we can't have Jimbo Jenkins God here, because he just F's with everything, and, you know, we can't protect our people all the time. I can even accept that. But I think it was this assumed that something would be too out of place, but it never got explained. We didn't get to hear from Xenagos much other than, I'm kind of fired up, and I'm going to do cool things once I get there. It's like he's a planeswalker that doesn't want to leave the plane. How that alone should be an interesting, worthy enough story for depth to say, you've seen all these other things, why do you want to stay here? This doesn't make any sense, who cares? Are you scared? Is it terror? Do you want to be loved because you feel a need that's missing and you feel like your life will end quickly as a planeswalker? I think that's interesting, and we got some of that weird mortal belief back in the old books. Arena even had that, where someone said, I'm going to give up my planeswalker abilities, or I'm not going to use them because I don't want that life. I don't want to be on the run. I don't want to have to worry about planeswalking and having to near die every time I do it. I don't want to have planeswalkers chase after me and kill me. I don't need that. And we need to see that. Not everyone's an Elspeth that's running from things or trying to avenge things or in movement or action between planes. There will be some that ascend and they're like, nah, I'm good. I like being a farmer. F that noise. And this could have been the perfect example for that of, I don't want to just be a farmer. That God thing looks kind of cool. Why don't I do that? I mean, that's reasonable. I mean, that's a paragraph. And I'd like to think there will be a conversation on that eventually. I'm sure if someone eventually spoils a style guide or it gets leaked, we'll probably learn. Because honestly, that sort of stuff is in there. It explains motivations. Why does the Phyrexian people go blah? Why is this here? And they write about it and they explain it. It's not always super in-depth, but there's always rationale. And I hope that gets out eventually. I mean, maybe it'll take like 80 beers at Gen Con, but it'll get out there. Hell, Brady Dommermuth doesn't work at Wizards anymore. He was a creative director forever. Maybe you could talk to him and just ask and be like, so, what's with this?
I was actually more invested in Ashiok, especially being an androgynous character and having all of the discussion that came from that. I was very happy to see people on Salvation talk about that and gender fluidity and things like that. And it was funny because I was watching these videos come out whenever a new set's been coming out lately. And they do like an inside R&D and, you know, Tom LaPille will talk about things and Mara will talk about things and Jenna Helland will. And in one of those videos, they reveal that Xenagos was not supposed to be the villain. It was supposed to be Ashiok. And I don't know if creative changed it or development changed it, but somebody changed it. And it went from being Ashiok, to no, we're going to do Xenagos. And to me, it kind of shows. It kind of shows that Xenagos was not meant to be the original bad guy. I really do feel like Ashiok would have been amazing. But I also heard rumors that part of the reason they didn't make Ashiok the bad guy was because of their gender-neutral status. And they didn't want to make the queer character the villain. You know what I mean? And well, I kind of understand that.
Originally, Ashiok was known as him. I don't know if you... The original thing that the first time that Ashiok got mentioned in a few of the stories, it was a he. How that changed, I don't know. Somehow, someone decided, oh, this would be a great example. Maybe it's when the art came in. Because when they... So a little behind the scenes. When the art comes in, it comes in different waves, and as people write names for characters or flavor text, you don't get to see the finalized art. You sometimes see a sketch. You sometimes see, you know, a group of sketches, maybe, I don't know. But you don't always get this full encompassing view. So I'd like to think Wizards is big enough to go beyond that to say, you know, we're not afraid to have a outside the norm character be evil. And I think of anything, that risk would have paid off huge. It's like, oh, we have a main character. Hell yes. Great. Don't care if they're evil or not. As long as the character doesn't die right away, fine. And then we get to learn a little more about that person.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was very sad to see that they didn't do more with Ashiok, and I still worry that they're not going to. I still worry about, you know, planeswalkers like Tamiyo, where, you know, she felt kind of shoehorned into that block. You have Ral Zarek, who people were really excited about just from the art, and Ral Zarek showed up for a moment in Dragon's Maze and really existed just to sort of kill the Izzet champion, be a little annoying to Jace and the others. And I really feel that's a problem. You know, it's kind of like, it reminds me of the show The L Word, which I don't expect you to have watched, but that's okay. And it's kind of the same thing. Where season one of The L Word, they had this really great 6-person cast of characters with so much depth to them and so much meat. Like, you could just, you know, so many things you could chew on and develop, and you could really have had multiple seasons with them. And then in season two, they, like, got rid of 2 of them but brought in 4 more and didn't really develop the 4 they already had. And then it just kept going. And on the one hand, you want to compliment them because they're making such awesome characters, but you've got to do something with them. Like, if you're going to go through all that trouble to make these awesome characters, you know, give them time, you know, take them places. Don't just give us a glimpse and then bring in more. It's too much.
Well, I mean, you know that these things are market tested quite well.
Sure.
I mean, every planeswalker, there's a reason why we see a billion Jaces. There's a reason why Sark and Vol, we only see 2. It's like, let's marinate on this a little bit. We'll see him a little more in the future. Same thing with Vraska not being, you know, all that popular. I'd love to see more of them, but with 44 planeswalkers, you can only put so many in a storyline, and you have to keep them repeating for people to get invested in them. And some of them will just kind of fall off the wayside. That's one of the bad things about the comic books being so focused on Dak Fade, and sweet Jesus, they love that guy. But instead of that,
and I didn't even know who he was when he was first spoiled. I didn't even know that there were comics.
Most people don't. But it's all his jam instead of it, as there was webcomics online and comics before, that you got the little glimpse in these other places and the little glimpses into what was the background story for Garrick. What was, you know, Elspeth's situation with relationship with the Johnny. And some of that is cost prohibitive. It's not cheap to make those. I know that. They made a book, and they commissioned extra chapter plates in the comic book. They made, like, a compendium. They made 2 compendiums, Path of the Planeswalker 1 and 2. 1 would have actually done pretty all right, but they spent a ton to make chapter plates, and it didn't sell well, of course. But, you know, if it doesn't make a ton of money, they're going to scrap it right away, because, you know, everything has to, you know, be positive in the profit margin, and quite big at that. And they can't always be pushing things into them to get that out of there. So, Agents of Artifice, they put a book chase in. Books are terrible, absolutely terrible. But they learned that if we put a promo in it that's relevant to people, which the old comics did not have, people will buy it. So these new comic books of, you know, we're going to put Turnabout in there, or we're going to put weird stuff that are, you know, not great promos, but decent enough that you stand still, okay, buy that. But these things will sell. That one character focus, I'd like to think that's going to end with ending the card, and they're going to try someone else on for size that can't really star in a set or a core set. Tom Reed might be a great one to really find out what is this all about. And if people hate it, well, you've only sunk a little bit of cost into a comic book instead of an entire marketing effort around someone like they did with Chandra, and it didn't really take off all that well.
Yeah, going back to Elsbeth, I just want to say one more thing about that. I was really I'm not mad that Elsbeth's dead. I did kind of think that redemption arc was going to go there, because from what I understand, she had a bit of a reputation for running from her problems. And I would have liked the idea of her staying and finally settling down and handling her shit. And if she happened to go out in a blaze of glory, or if she happened to do it to save a village or whatever, I would have really been fine with that. I've been watching Xena while I'm at work lately. and shotgunning that. And I seem to recall that's how Xena ended. You know, she gets all the way through 8 seasons, she does all of this good, and then it comes down to you have to die so this ghost army doesn't come back or whatever. And she goes out like a freaking warrior. You're not really that sad to see Xena go. I mean, you are a little bit, but, you know, she died like a warrior, like you would think she would. And, you know, if that would have been Elsbeth's end, I would have been okay with that. But when she dies for love, like, she meets a guy, and from what I understand, Daxos is kind of frosty to her. Like, I'm under the impression it's not like... Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all.
Okay, because I'm under the impression, like, it's not like this great open arms kind of, I'm going to tell you everything about me, love. I'm under the impression he's, like, very difficult. She has to sort of, like, pull teeth for every little bit of, you know, anything she gets from the guy. And that's who she ends it for? Like, and even then, why does the woman planeswalker have to give it up for love?
Yeah.
To me, that just seemed very cliche.
It's beyond cliche. It's a trope. It's...
Yeah.
Adam Butterfly, Miss Saigon, it's a thing. I'm not happy they use that thing, but it's, you know, it's a little old hat this day and age, but Elspeth really identified with humans. I mean, she never thought herself above things because she still got concerned with grief and torment that would be, you know, normal planeswalkers wouldn't care. They're like, I'm just going to go somewhere else. And she couldn't let that part of humanity go. So I'm not surprised it happened with that. I'd be even more willing to see that, oh, she drank poison and died. Oh, sorry about that. You know, just some stupid reason, because that's who she is. She's this person that really gets infected by any sort of minor thing. She doesn't have a thick skin. That's Elspeth. But if they would have even looked at how much people really enjoy Elspeth's character as the first woman that has depth, I mean, really, it's the first and probably the only, as of right now, that people can relate to. Because Jace, everyone relates to, cool, neat, fine. Elspeth is really the only woman that does. No one else relate to Liliana. Yeah, you can kind of do it, but, you know, there's that line that it's just hard to cross to get put yourself in that situation.
The last thing I want to talk about while I have you here is artist etiquette. Because when we were at GP Minneapolis, I wasn't sure. I'd never approached an artist before about how to have something signed or anything like that. And I remember one of the things I was really concerned about was tipping. Like, I had went into the situation expecting to tip them. And through numerous people I talked to, I found out that that wasn't the case, that artists actually tend to be very surprised when they receive tips for autographs and things like that, which was very strange to me. So what are some other interactions or some other pointers you can give to people like me who want to approach artists either by mail or at a con and we want them to sign our cards? How do we go about this? What should we know?
Sure. I've written about this in the past, and I know I do a really crappy job of referring back to my old articles. I mean, I really should like Mike Flores it up and just rehash things again and again, but I can't. So, I mean, these things are out there, and the basic things you need to know is that they're really there to make a profit on the weekend. And there's a lot of places nationally, especially in the U.S., that they could possibly lose money by coming to your GP or to your Star City Games Open. And people don't really think about that. And if they have a really crappy weekend, you know what? They're never going to come back to Cleveland. They're never going to go back to Raleigh. Just because it's not worth it. The risk is just too high. The same thing happened with Spectrum Live, that, you know, it's great to see other artists, but if you can't make any money, what are you doing? So when they have their offerings out, in my experience, it's best to go up and get something right away. Don't wait and say, I'm going to see how much money I have left over, because one, they might run out of crap. Two, they might be so busy that you don't really get a good experience out of it. And three, you know what? If artists make all their table costs and, you know, flight and all the food costs on the first, like, 2 hours, they are so much happier the rest of the weekend. They're willing to do extra doodles. All of the playmats are better for everyone. It really just raises the experience for the entire venue. And I don't think tournament organizers quite picked up on that yet, of if someone buys an original art day one, like a painting for, like, $800, everyone will be talking about that event forever for everything that they interacted with that artist. So that's the big thing. Get your stuff early. The second thing is, if you want to get any sort of playmat done or a sketch or anything of that sort, again, do it early as you can, and really look to see what the lion is doing. If you want to give something to Randy Post or Steve Argyle, there's always going to be a line, so that doesn't matter. But some of the other artists that have maybe been out of the game a little while and have come back, and people are like, who's this guy? They're like, oh, he doesn't have anything in Federalist Block for Standard. I don't need him to sign anything. And it's like, that's Richard Kane Ferguson. The dude made everything back in the day. And if you ever see them alone, you can talk to them and just say, hey, you know, can I get these signed? You add a dollar into a playset, which I hope becomes an acceptable standard of, if you put a playset in, put a buck in. If you put two cards in, you put a buck in. Because those things add up really quickly. Dan Scott and Randy Post really talk about this, because they've got it down to a science of the 10, 20, 40 sort of alterations. And that sort of business plan actually makes more money than their prints. Because it's a space thing. You can get four cards done for $40 with an alteration and maybe a little fun little pencil sketch. You know, maybe Randy Post cock on, you know, some beasts or things, because God knows he loves doing that. He can't do it. He's not supposed to do it, but, you know, it happens, whatever. But a playmat takes up way more space than that. It might only cost $25. So artists really need to start looking at how can you bundle these things together of, oh, I'm going to make this thing $15 and this card thing $5, and then I get a $20 bill in my pocket. And then as a player, you can say, okay, I got $20 here from an ATM. How can I maximize what I get out of the artist right away? I want to get a print and another thing and a sketch for this, this, and this, and I want my commander signed. And generally, if you say, you know, I've got this, you can make something happen. If it's early in the con, you know, they're willing to get something just to get out of the way. If it's the end of the con, it's like, well, no. I don't really need money now. I'm doing amazingly well. So you come early for that. Other things I would tend to do is be very specific on what you want for anything of a larger value. For example, if you just want a doodle on something, $10, who cares? But if you want a playmat done for $50, $100, $500, whatever, you got to be really, really mindful of what that person is doing. And the best way to do that is always check their Tumblr pages, because people post a lot of their alteration stuff there, or some of the work that they're doing for, you know, private commissions, and you can really get a grasp on what those things are. A great example would be Steve Belladon. He doesn't really do a ton of playmats. Can he? Sure he can. But giving him, you know, $250 and saying, Steve, knock this up for me today, you know, it's probably not the best use of his time, and he'll probably be like, oh, you know, I'll do the best I can. But that's not really a skill set. You do it to Randy Post, and he'll do it in an hour, and other artists will hate him for it, how fast he works. But, you know, you'll actually get the thing that you want and the expectations you have. So always research the person, and they're all out there. I made an artist contact list for an old Gathering Magic. You can search Gathering Magic and my name and, you know, contact artist, and it has all the people, every artist ever that I could find, including some of the dead ones. And you can look into their pages to see what are they working on, what's the new that they've got, and really plan accordingly. Other things you got to look, I would look into is if you only have a couple of bucks on you, get an artist proof. Usually they're always $5, but you know, you see that stack and there's still 48 of them out of the 50 they have in Italian, you know, you say, come on, can I get a $3? And they're like, oh, you want, okay, fine. So at least you get something out of it to commemorate that activity or thing you went to. Because artists don't always randomly show up to pre-release in Cedar Rapids, you know, that doesn't always happen. But if it's for a GP, you're going to keep that forever. You're going to get fond memories of that event of, oh, I scrubbed out, but I got this story, and I talked to, you know, this artist, and it was great, and I had a fun time, and I want to go back to it next time. So I'd always pick up the low-value items. Even if they're not on the table, they're always underneath the table. I guarantee that, especially artist proofs.
And I will say, I tipped my autograph people. I actually gave RK Post $5 to sign my Fulminators. And, cause to me, that was nothing to me. That was pocket change. And he's RK Post. And they're Fulminator mages, you know? And he was also courteous enough to make sure that he was signing in like a good place, you know? He didn't just have this huge Sharpie and wrote all over the text box, or he didn't cover the art. He had like a fine point Sharpie, and he picked a corner of the text box. And that was awesome. You know, I really really didn't know how he would handle that. And he seemed really surprised by the tip, which I found very odd. I'm like, really? And I will also say, going back to what you said about artists handling their business well, RK Post, maybe it's just because he's so popular and he had so much to do, I don't know. But the only thing that sticks in my mind about that is when we left on Saturday, like when we got done with the main event and we went to the after parties, he was still doing stuff. Like, after every artist had went home, most of the vendors were starting to fold up, he was still sketching, doodling, signing, and he probably didn't have to. And I just thought that was really amazing, because every other artist was just like, bye. And he knew why he was there, and he squeezes the most out of his time. And he's one of the few artists, I think, that is the most savvy about the game. Like, he knows what to do.
Well, I mean, tournament organizers recognize that, too, to say, you do a lot of work. We want to get the person that's going to be there hustling all day, making my customers happy, giving them a good experience, so that the next time I come here, I do that. So the converse to him would be probably John Avon, who has some health problems, and everyone wants to come to your event, but one, there's airfare. Two, he's not in the best health. He can't work 8 hours, 10 hours straight and just be signing all day. Now, most people don't care and just want that signature and just want that artist proof, because it's so valuable, because it's become rare. To even Therese Nielsen, she's going to be at Gen Con. It's going to be hard not to go to Gen Con because she's there. She's giving a frickin' workshop on alterations. It's absurd. So those sort of rare people kind of balance out the, you know, the high volume sort of things, but, you know, it's harder to take a risk on those people. So I see the new artists that, you know, could really learn a lot by looking at these really prolific artists that really help the community. And I hate to say it, but some of that fan service stuff of staying late and meeting Liliana into what have you cheapens a little bit of, you know, the brand, sure, but it also makes the experience better for the user. So just simply signing a thing and being like, oh, thanks, that's fun, is, you know, isn't in the best interest, because people are going to post this to Reddit. They're going to post it to Facebook and be like, you know, that artist was kind of a dick. I don't really want to talk to that guy again or that woman. Wasn't that fun of an experience? And that word will get out, and that person won't get invited to things again.
Do you think it's also that these artists are not thinking of the long term? Like, they're thinking of it as, oh, I just made a sketch for Magic the Gathering. They're not thinking in, like, a lucrative sense of what I can, you know, sort of like you see with pro players, where you see pro players who just sort of live in the now, and they don't think about, well, what happens if I don't make enough money for this, or what happens when I stop doing well? They're just sort of in it for the short term.
No,
do you think that that's the case with artists, too, where they're not thinking of how can I maximize this?
I don't think so. I think some of them really have a good sense on, I need to get into Magic as quick as I can, because that drives traffic. Peter Moorbacher, who has done amazing stuff in the Theros block, and he even publicly stated, learning something in an anime convention, saying, I didn't have enough Magic stuff. People know kind of who I am, but Magic draws people in. People will buy prints of Magic stuff just because it's Magic stuff. It's the same thing of, I want a Tarmogoyf print. Not because the art is amazing, but it's because it's Tarmogoyf. And you never know when you have those commons that are, you know, really relevant, like Ponder, that all of a sudden, you know, you can sell a print for $25. And your other print that you might have made amazing for some self-titled project, you can't sell for that much. So they do understand that point of Magic drives traffic, traffic drives sales. If I get into Magic, it's going to help my career immensely. And looking at a few artists, Peter Moorbacher would be one, to see how he's interacting with that. Second person I would look at right away is Tyler Jacobson, to see how that's really shot up his career into what he's doing. And other people would be like Donato. Donato Giancola doesn't go to a lot of things. He's an art teacher. He's a fine artist. He's amazingly good. But every time he goes, he has Magic prints with him. He brings his Magic proofs. His Magic folk will show up and ask for them. And those $5, $10 sales, man, hugely important. Sign the thing, they're going to come back. It might not be right away, but these things will reoccur, that they'll tell a friend and they'll tell a friend. And somehow through this cosmic connection, that they're going to get more sales because they had a good experience. Now, there are the surly artists that don't quite get that, but they don't get invited to a lot of stuff. You don't see them very often. And unfortunately, I would love to see, you know, two really popular in the now, in standard people, and then you have two other people that have been out of the game a little while, but might have done a bunch of stuff back in the day. Might have done 20 pieces, and, you know, two of them became amazing staples. Those are the people that don't quite understand all the needs that people want, and they're the ones who kind of fall behind in sales and popularity because they don't get that. But everyone now, if they have a DeviantArt or Tumblr, they understand that fully of how important it is to get into Magic.
So, Mike, if anybody's enjoyed listening to you on the show and they want to know more about your work or they want to get a hold of you, how can they do that?
Sure. I write a weekly column that drops every Tuesday night at midnight Eastern Time, 11 p.m. Central for where I live, and that's thegatheringmagic.com. So it's my I write a column called Painter's Servant, and it really focuses on art and flavor and things. I'm on the Twitters at Worthos Mike, which I voraciously use. And then, otherwise, if they want to get a hold of me, you can easily do a Google search for my last name, which has a lot of N's, I know, and find me, and get a hold of me, because I have a lot of people interested in original art, or have a question of how do I get a hold of this artist, or how do I get a print of things, and I'm always willing to help them do that, because I want them to experience, you know, art every day, or magic every day, that if you put your cards down, you have a baby, if you have art on the wall, you'll feel connected to the game. You'll feel like you're somewhat there. And I want to push that in everything I do.
Mm-hmm. And you really are one of the few people on the Magic site that's actually talking about this. I'm really glad that you do that. And I want to thank you for coming on the show to talk about this.
Yeah, you're very welcome anytime. I mean, if there's ever an art-related thing you want to know about, you can always poke me with a stick. I always have an opinion on it.
And you can always poke me with a stick, too. Oh. Well, thank you again for coming on the show.
You're very welcome.
And if anyone else is listening and you've enjoyed what you've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. It really does help me. It helps me get visibility. It helps me get the show out there. It lets people know what I'm doing. So it really does matter. And also leave some stars if you can. You can follow what the show is up to on Twitter at the Deck Tees. You can follow me on Twitter at Original Estrus. And you can also email me personally at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you guys very much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay?